Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Frances Fawcett. Fawcett is a freelance scientific illustrator, painter, and graphic designer. She is a graduate of Oberlin College, where she majored in studio art. She formerly worked at Cornell University as an illustrator in the entomology department and also taught science illustration in the Cornell Summer Program. Her traditional media of choice was acrylics, carbon dust, and pen and ink, but she currently works mostly in digital. And she is a member of Ithaca's State of the Art Gallery. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want you to tell us how you discovered art and how you segued into illustration. Tell us that whole beginning.
I always liked art. As a child, I drew a lot. My parents loved museums, took us. I grew up in western New York, south of Buffalo. And at least once a month, we went to the Albright or the Natural History Museum or the History Center. And I loved the Albright. Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo was quite a wonderful place. But my first love in high school was biology, and I intended to be a biology major. But when I got to college, I was taking studio art at the same time as I was taking introductory biology. And when it was time to choose my major, and I realized I was going to have to take chemistry, organic chemistry, calculus, and those were extremely difficult courses at Oberlin. And I just thought, you know what? I don't need to do this. I could major in art and take the occasional biology course and not have to do the hard science. So that's what I chose.
That's really interesting. So you must have known that you had a talent for art, or was that always?
No, I thought I did, but it was a little disconcerting. At the time the time I was born into, the late 60s, the art world was not a place that was very interested in any kind of representational art. Mm. At the time, it was abstract expressionism, minimalism, hard-edged, geometric things, and very design-oriented in lots of ways. And those were fun, actually. I started really liking those, but I still am really drawn to realism. Oh. But I did a lot of those hard-edged things to begin with and got into it. I liked it a lot. I realized I wasn't going to be able to make money as an artist, so I got a master's in library science after college.
Really?
Because the second love is books and libraries. Third love, I guess. And it wasn't until we moved the 80s, early 80s, we moved to Ithaca, and I had little kids, and it was time to get a job because they were starting to go to school. And Cornell had through the Hortorium, not through the Fine Art Program, mind you, through the Hortorium, there was a science illustration course offered, 2 hours. And I thought, you know what, I could take that. And that would do what I want.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did. It was taught by Ann Elliott, a very fun person, very dreamy person. She told me she no longer ever drove because she was so distracted by the way light fell on lines and surfaces.
Wow.
And defined shapes. And
so you learned you learned illustrations from her.
I started looking at things that way, how light falls on things and defines shape and volume. And it was a natural match. I just took off on it. I loved it.
Wow. And your stuff is beautiful.
Well, thank you.
It really is. You know what I want to ask you, too? Scientific illustration, is it approached in different ways than when you're doing other kinds of fine art or
drawing? I have a story about that. And
sure.
My major professor, Paul Arnold at Oberlin, a printmaker, very fine printmaker, he did a Japanese woodblock print technique that was lovely. And when I told him I was interested in going, I thought, oh, maybe I'll do medical illustration, I said to him. And he said, oh, don't do that. It will just spoil your technique.
Wow.
It will spoil everything. You'll just be, all you'll be able to do is picky little picky things. And I thought, okay, I won't. So that's why I went to library school.
Oh,
I forgot that part of the story. What did I know? Naive 20-year-old.
Yeah, but, and just sort of inventing what you wanted
yes,
to do.
Right.
Wow.
So, but I got back into it in my 30s, so when I came here. So that was nice. Then the very summer that I had taken that course in the spring here at Cornell, the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators, which is a national organization that was started 50 years ago in Washington, D.C., by people that did illustration, mostly for the Smithsonian, ran their summer workshop here at Cornell, which was a two-week-long sessions of all kinds of different techniques, pen and ink, carbon dust, watercolor, scratchboard.
And which were you most attracted to?
I loved them all. It was just such an exploration of things I'd never tried.
Wow.
Different media. Oh, fun. And all taught by a person who really loved that particular technique. Jerry Hodges from Chicago, who was he's now deceased, but he, at the time, was an absolute master of a technique called eyelashing with pen and ink, where you make parallel lines of different thicknesses, and you will have, if you saw one, you would recognize it from old botanical and medical illustrations from past times. A beautiful way of defining volume. And so he was there teaching it. And
so you fell into the right spot at the right
moment. It was perfect. And went right from that summer. The entomology department was advertising for, one of the professors was advertising for an illustrator, and I applied and got that job with him.
Tell us about how you approach the illustration, though. Is medical illustration supposed to be totally realistic, or do you have time to play around with the fine art
well,
part of it?
I'm not actually a medical illustrator. That's a specialty that where you have to take anatomy and various things, especially now, you know, as the way areas get more and more narrow and you need more and more education to master a specialized thing. And it's medical illustration is its own very competitive field. So I define myself as a natural science illustrator, and I do much more general biological illustration. But how I go about doing an illustration...
Yeah, and what's the criterion that if somebody asks you to do an illustration?
Well, I ask them what it will involve, and it can be anything from an original concept. Someone says, I just need an ecological drawing showing these different creatures living in an environment, and then you have the freedom to arrange them any way you want in a... hopping around in a field or a woods or flying in.
So you can be creative aspect of it. Wow.
Or it can just be, I need all these old illustrations redrawn in the same style, and they'll give you a lot of illustrations from different illustrators from the past 100 years on a specific subject, perhaps, and... usually they're anatomy drawings of some kind of animal. In my case, it's usually insects because I was working in the entomology department. And then you have to redraw. You have the drawing that you need to redraw in a way that will make all these coherent in their book so that they don't look like they're reproduced from a million different sources, some of which are pretty bad and often don't show enough of what needs to be shown. So then you need to go to the collection and get an actual specimen and look at it under the microscope and find out what it was they were really trying to show.
That's interesting. I wondered if you use real...
Oh, yes.
Real
a lot.
True to life.
A lot. What I was doing when I first worked in the entomology department, I was working for Quentin Wheeler, who was a coleopterist, studied beetles. And he needed, besides the anatomy drawings, and a lot of them were genitalia, because the differences in a lot of these little tiny beetles can only be told by dissecting out their genitalia to see that they really are different. And these were little tiny beetles that feed on slime mold spores. When the slime molds flower, there's lots of different species of slime molds, and each one has different species of beetles that feed on them, but they're pinhead size. So you can only really get at them by using a dissecting microscope and then dissecting out the genitalia, which fortunately I didn't have to do the dissections. But they're tiny. And for those, God, even a dissecting microscope is not enough. Sometimes you need to use an optical.
Wow, that's an amazing skill to be able to do that.
Well, I had to learn it.
Better and better as
right.
You.
Right, it's practice.
You know what somebody asked me too when I told them that I was going to be interviewing you. Why don't people who do illustrations for medical and scientific journals use photographs?
We do.
But why
do they want drawings rather than photographs? Because often the photograph is so filled with extraneous information that it's very hard to focus on what they want to show. So
you can get more detail.
You can draw exactly what they want to show and leave out all the, especially with medical illustration, like a complex body part or operation, and that you can show exactly the particular blood vessels and things that they want shown, rather than having all the intervening pieces of muscle and all that. And the same is true with the insects.
Wow.
And you can leave out the dirt and the and the extra stuff. Like, the insects aren't, they're sometimes covered with dust and spores.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
So now they don't need, so the other thing I did besides the anatomy drawings for Quentin Wheeler were what's called a habitus drawing, which is a whole insect. So when someone would describe a new species, and it would be published in one of the entomological journals, it's a portrait of the insect, a formal portrait, usually from the dorsal view, that is the top, the back of the insect with its six legs in a symmetrical pose. And it was, you needed to an artist to do that, because often these very three-dimensional insects, when you look at them through the microscope and try to take a picture through the microscope, only one little part of them is in focus. And I could get the whole thing in focus by focusing down while I was drawing, and I was using something called a camera lucida, where you can see your hand and the thing through the and the specimen through the scope, so you can trace the edge of the specimen and get the exact position of it while you're looking at it, and then you've got a good outline, and then you can do the drawing once you know where the placement is, and you can get the whole thing beautifully in focus. Well,
wow.
In, I'd say maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, a new technique, a new kind of equipment came in because of computers, where a camera that was attached to a microscope could take multiple pictures at different focal points, and then the computer would put those all together in a three-dimensional image that was completely in focus.
Wow.
So now that part of my job is taken over by the confocal microscope or the stacking, what they call focal stacking or something like that. Anyway, so I don't do those anymore, but those were really, really, very fun to do.
Oh, okay. And you also do fine art for yourself, don't you? And so how do you approach that? You're interested in the natural sciences, obviously, and nature, so.
Well, if I'm lucky, something will catch my interest and it'll, and I'll get very enthused about it, and then it's an obsession until I get it down. And I, if I'm lucky, the enthusiasm will carry through the horribly hard work of it.
Oh,
so that doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of unfinished things. But when it does happen, it's the most fun thing in the world. It's just the best.
Oh, I'll bet.
I love it.
I'll bet. And you mainly paint, you use acrylics, right? I mean,
I used to. I started out, that's what I did in college for the straight hard edge stuff. And then when I went back after, when I joined the State of the Art Gallery about 12 years ago maybe, I decided I would go back to that and do landscapes and stuff in acrylic, and I did. But then as the science illustration got more and more digital and everything was, I was doing everything on with Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop, I started doing my own art also on the computer.
Yeah.
And so the last show I just had at the State of the Art was all digital. And I really got into some of those things. They're very, very exciting, realistic, and Some were abstract. We had a series. The person I did the show with, Susan Larkin, the photographer, and there were a few poems by her poet husband. It was really fun, a fun collaboration. But we had this one Fibonacci section of our show where everything had to do with the Fibonacci spiral and the natural forms like the center of a sunflower or the scales on a pine cone that follow that mathematical formula of growth.
Wow. And
so that was, we both got very excited about that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frances Fawcett. She is a freelance scientific illustrator and painter, and we are discussing some of her work here today. I wanted to ask you, Do you approach teaching science in any particular way? Illustration.
Yes. Well, I do teach it sometimes. If someone asks me to teach a workshop, I'm happy to do it. Well, depending on where it is and a few other factors, like whether there will be any kind of pay. But I have taught some at the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators Summer Conferences. I've taught carbon dust several times. That's really my the technique that I'm kind of a specialist in.
You know what? I want to know what carbon dust painting and art is.
Carbon
I've never
dust,
heard of it.
I know. No, hardly anyone has. It's a specialty. It's what you end up with is a black and white, a grayscale drawing that can look as real as a photograph. Very smooth gradations, very subtle interplays of light and shadow, and very fine detail are possible. And that's what I did. A lot of the beetle habitus drawings were done in carbon dust. And it's a very interesting medium because you apply the dust of carbon pencils, which is a very black dust. It's blacker than charcoal dust.
Wow.
It's pure carbon. You apply that dust to a substrate, either a paper or clay, or in my case, I use a mylar film with a very fine tooth, which is like a plastic film, a drawing film. You apply it with little brushes so that you brush it on and you get smooth gradients, sort of painted on. And then you can get very dark blacks and you can get a nice gradation through black to light. And then you can go back in with a kneaded eraser and take the dust off and get right back to white. So you can go back and forth with this drawing, and it's forgiving. It's not like watercolor where you often can really make a mistake that's not fixable. So I loved it because of that. And it's a match when you reach a medium that you like.
Is that a technique that only scientific artists use or do fine artists
Pretty much.
Use?
It came to this country at the turn of the century with a man called Max Brodel from Germany, in a medical illustrator who used it for medical illustration. And then it turned out to be perfect for beetles because they're black.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So then there was a certain few people who did beetle illustration in that technique.
Wow.
But now it's not really. You can completely imitate it in Photoshop. So I do things in Photoshop now that I would often have done.
You can't do the creative.
Well, I did
creative work.
I did. I took carbon dust out and did about 10 years ago. I did 6 landscapes in little. Some of them were detailed microcosms, and other ones were regular landscapes with trees and animals in carbon dust, just to see how it would work as a. I have a couple. I've grown
and
a couple,
how did
it?
How
can't.
Did it work? What was that?
Beautifully.
Challenging.
I 2 of them sold for quite hefty amounts, and
wow.
2 of them I've given to my kids, and 2 of them I still have. So one of them was bought by the New York State Museum for their collection.
God,
so that
wonderful.
Was nice.
What an interesting technique. It doesn't seem to me many people would be using
they
that
don't,
even now.
But a few do. There was another artist in Ithaca who used it too.
Yeah, I had never heard of that. You know, I want to ask you too. You joined the State of the Art Gallery, 10 or 12 years ago, you said. Well, what prompted you to join that? Artists always seem so, you know, almost reclusive in some ways.
I felt like I felt a desire to be out there a little bit and not just have it be friends and family seeing what I did.
Uh-huh. And people who buy your illustrations in Scientific Journal.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, and it's been quite satisfactory. I'm not very good at promoting or hustling about myself, but that's a nice venue. You know, you have a chance to show something 8 months of the year in the salon, and you have a chance to have a show every couple of years in the front of the gallery. It's just about right for me.
But you like to talk to people about your work, right?
It's fun.
Even though it's hard to explain some of the techniques.
Uh-huh.
Have you learned anything from some of the people you've talked to?
Oh, heavens. All the time.
All bad.
This last show, we called it Stimulus Response because we were just going back and forth with each other's ideas. And you know, see an idea, grab it, make it your own, make something. It was just wonderful.
Yeah,
I think that happens all the time in the art world.
I think it happens a lot, but I have met some artists who are reluctant to really talk that much. You know, they say minimal about their work or themselves. You know. You know what I was wondering too? Can you exhibit your scientific work even if it's been sold to a medical journal?
If I still own the copyright.
Okay, so they don't insist that they get to own the copyright?
Well, if they do, I can say, sorry, I'm not interested in taking this job if I can't either own the copyright or retain the right to have it in my portfolio and exhibit it when I wish. I don't necessarily want to sell it again.
Yeah.
But I very much object to not being able to have my own work in my own portfolio. Or
does that happen very often that they insist
no,
that
because
they own it?
I'm just not out there enough. I don't. It's been a freelance part-time job for me. It's not. I've never been able to make. I don't hustle enough to be able to make a living doing it. In other words, but it's a sore point. It's a delicate situation with the copy of that whole copyright.
Yeah,
ownership of art thing. Things I do for Cornell, and when I was an employee of Cornell, the copyright is Cornell's. But there's never would I don't think anybody object to me having the pieces I did for them at least in my own portfolio, as long as I'm not making any money off of it. Why would that be a problem?
Oh, yeah.
But now if I take a job, like I've had two books recently that I've been illustrating for Cornell biologists for Princeton. Their Princeton Press is doing the publishing, and they want the illustrator to sign a contract, and I won't.
Reverts to their copyright?
I said I'm not going to do it if I don't have copyright of my own art.
I think that makes sense.
And they didn't make me sign that, so it was okay.
Have you ever worked on a, like, gotten a commission to draw something for a scientific journal and decided, I want to keep this for myself. I'm not even going to give
that
to
them. A lot of times they don't want it.
They
just want to reproduce it in that article. And you have the original then to do what you want with, and you can sell it if you want or put it on your wall.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was almost like freelance for them, too. They're
a lot of times just interested in having an illustration for that particular purpose.
And then you get credit, though, right?
Yes,
they
credit you.
Did you enjoy the public aspect of making art and talking about your work? And
well, this is kind of fun. I'm enjoying this today. I don't do it too often. Well, usually when I teach a workshop, I'll tell a little bit about carbon dust and how I got into it.
I mean, some artists, I mean, they just feel like they can't talk about their work, but they come here and talk about it. See, you have to point that out to some people.
Well...
Yeah. Well, what advice would you give people who are aspiring to be artists, not necessarily scientific illustrators, but
practice.
Artists in general?
Do it. Every day, draw. The more you do it, the better you get. The more you see, the more you can see the way light falls on things. Because really, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Light.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. I didn't ever think I was very good at sketching. Just like So about 15 years ago, we went out to visit one of our daughters in California and took a trip up the coast. And I said, on this trip, I'm going to do a sketch every single day without fail. I took my sketchbook along, and I did. Well, it was 2 weeks, and by the end of that 2 weeks, I was producing decent sketches. And that was only 14 days of sketching every day. And that just brought it home to me how...
So was that the first time you ever really did it in that kind
like
of concentrated
in that
fashion?
Kind of concentrated way, yes. I know there's some people that just draw every day, but I wasn't one of them. I like to get grabbed by an idea, and then I'll start going to town, but it's not a daily practice. But this just showed me that that's what it takes.
Yeah.
Also, the science illustration, the technical aspect of that is a very learnable thing. Almost anybody can learn to do a decent technical drawing.
Really?
Oh, yes.
I can't imagine that.
Yes.
When I think about myself, I've never been able to really draw. I mean, of cartoonish kinds of things.
There's rules. There are the way you shade an object. The light in a science illustration always comes from the upper left. And you've seen those in beginning drawing books. They'll have a sphere, a cone, a cube that you shade. And those are all just by rules, which side gets the light and how it defines the volume. And just by doing that, we used to see this all the time, Benta and I, when we taught that summer course at Benta King, who died about 10 years ago now, that students would come in gung-ho to learn it or reluctant, saying, I always wanted to do this, but I don't think I'm very good. And we would say, well, just see. And it was a rigorous course. So they had to draw every day. It was just amazing. And they were so happy.
People can learn a technique, but are they also needing to bring in a little bit of talent?
If they want to take it further.
We've all met people who know how to draw a square.
So any scientist or graduate student in science could learn the basic techniques of how to do an anatomical drawing to illustrate their own journals by taking a basic science illustration course. Anybody could.
Wow.
You'd have to be very... I don't think that could happen for a Cornell student who could see, whose eyes worked. I think they could learn it.
Well, Frances, we're almost out of time. Can you tell us how people can get in touch with you? Do you have any exhibits coming up in the near future?
I am a member of the State of the Art Gallery, so I have a page there. I recently built a website, and just this last month, because I needed something to do after that show was done, and I'd never had one before, francisfawcett.com. So it's
and they can contact
built.
You
they
that
can,
way, right?
They can contact me on the site. There's a contact page.
Terrific. Well, this has been a great pleasure to talk to you about this stuff. I'm sure some of our listeners have learned about the fact that they could probably be a scientific illustrator.
They could.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.